service of a fictional self as she lived with this psychic disfigurement. Her internal dialogue now, some 20 years after her first trip and exploitation by her father, still sabotaged her. The tapes that raged in her head spoke of worthlessness and hopelessness. Her labels were dirty, whore, and slut. Her locus of control was irrationally internal, and the fixed beliefs that defined her life script offered her no way out. Okay, having learned something about Rhonda's situation for a point of reference, let's put the plan to work in your life using Rhonda's tragic and toxic life chain as an example. I have found that the best approach by far is to take one triggering event, that first link that you'll identify in step one, and to follow it through the entire series of five steps. Bring every step of the plan to bear on that event before you take up another separate event and start working on it. Don't rush the process. I make no apology for the fact that this work is time and labor intensive. If you rush the work, if you skim the information rather than committing yourself to an honest and thorough self-appraisal, then a superficial result is all you'll get. As before, get your journal and find the quietest, most private place and time you can. Ideally, you will be able to set aside a solid hour or more and take one event through the entire five-step process. Depending on your particular target or triggering event, you may find that the process takes several sessions scattered across several days. Understand that I want you to dig until you find the absolute bottom in terms of your internal reactions. For each step, consider Rhonda's situation and possible responses as examples only. Your answer should be the result of quiet reflection on and honest appraisal of your own life. If your events are less dramatic than Rhonda's, thank God, don't be deterred. If an event is important to you, then that is enough for it to qualify for your full attention and effort. Step 1. Target the event. With a quiet attention to your own breathing and a relaxed mind and body, consider your life chain, the series of events, circumstances, and responses that have made you who you are at this moment. Begin by deciding which, among those key external events that you identified earlier, has been the single most toxic factor in your life. It will be one of the following: a defining moment, a critical choice, or a pivotal person. Now, write a short description of that target event. This description need not be more than a few sentences and may already be captured in what you wrote earlier. However, you may have changed since that first writing, and if you need to edit or add to that response, do so now. By way of example, here is what Rhonda wrote in her first step. On that first Tuesday morning in June, as he began loading up the car, he told me to pack my things and get ready to go. I knew him, I hated him, and I knew that I shouldn't get in that car with him. I had no idea what was going to happen, but I knew that I'd regret it. I could have run to the kitchen and begged my mom to let me stay with her. I could have run away. Or maybe, if I'd said it right, I could have persuaded my mother to come with us and protect me. Instead, I did just what he told me to do. That was, at one and the same time, both my number one most toxic defining moment and my most devastating critical choice. That was the most horrible choice I've ever made. Now, I know that you're probably thinking, that's crazy. How could she have any responsibility or accountability for what this sick bastard did? You're exactly right. But remember, this is Rhonda's confused, guilt-induced internal reaction, and it reflects the fiction that she has been living with ever since. Obviously, it is not rational, but try telling that to a scared and guilt-ridden 12-year-old girl. Step 2. Audit your internal response to that target or triggering event. Use the following questions to stimulate your thoughts. Number 1. Where do you place responsibility or blame for the event? What is your locus of control? For example, the first series of questions I addressed to Rhonda were, to whom do you attribute the responsibility for this event? Did you really have a choice at 12 years old to refuse to get into the car? Did you, could you, know what was going to happen? Did you make the rapes happen? Do you own the sickness of your father and the other perverts that he hung out with? I'm quite sure that both you and I can see that the answer for Rhonda should be no. But again, we have a different perspective than that of a 12-year-old girl under the control of her father or a 35-year-old woman who is stuck in that past history. My next question to Rhonda, which still related to this issue of placing responsibility, was who decided then and who decides now how you're going to respond to this event? Who decides what horrible things you were saying to yourself then and what horrible things you say to yourself now? Since no one can insert this reaction from the outside, Rhonda's answer had to be, well, I guess I made the choices then, and I guess I make them now. Next question. Were you actually in control of the situation? This question focuses directly on responsibility and shame. You would be astonished by the number of people who shame themselves for events in which they were only the victim, not the perpetrator. In addition, many families desperately want such events swept away, and so they deem the victim guilty for being so selfish as to want to make it public, or in any way force it to be dealt with. Apply these questions about locus of control to your own event and write your answers down. A caution here. Do not write what you intellectually think you should say. It's easy to guess what the correct or socially desirable answer is. That's not what I want you to write down and see. Write what you really think when you are alone and living with the most toxic event in your life. You can't change what you don't acknowledge, so be brutally honest here. What do you really believe about responsibility for your event, whether you intellectually know better or not? In other words, be real about what you honestly think. Number 2. What has been the tone and content of your internal dialogue since that target or triggering event? On those occasions when you reflect on the event, what do you say to yourself? On those occasions when you're not reflecting directly on the event, but it causes you to experience guilt and shame, what is it that you say to yourself then, even if it does not specifically reference the event? In other words, how does this spill over into other areas of your life? As Rhonda's responses might suggest, many victims of sexual abuse report that at first they did not perceive or would not allow themselves to perceive what was actually going on. Many victims of molestation, for example, report that they first thought that they were getting special attention and that only as the events continued did they discover more destructive intentions. Some feel fooled and stupid for their naivete. Others purposefully design different perceptions in order to protect their assailant, especially if it's a family member. Whether your event was similar to Rhonda's or completely, totally different, relevant questions might be, what was your perception of your behavior? What was your perception of the intentions or behaviors of others involved in the situation? What are you telling yourself about those things today? How does the way in which you have labeled and reacted to this event affected your confidence and style of engaging the world? If a negative internal dialogue appears to be a result of this event, describe that dialogue in writing. Understand that the internal dialogue may not be specifically about the event. It may be an internal dialogue that is laced with messages of doubt and incompetence that flow from, even indirectly, your most toxic event. If some event shook your faith in you, even though the current day manifestation does not involve specific references to that origin, it is still highly relevant. Number 3, what labels have you generated for yourself as a result of your event? As a consequence of your event, what have you told yourself about you? Rhonda discovered that she used labels for herself such as dirty or damaged goods. Consider whether you too have come up with labels for yourself, labels that you use as a result of this specific event. Review the labels you wrote down when we discussed labels earlier and add to or take away from that list. You may discover more labels now that you have been working on all of this so much. Write those labels down. Number 4. What tapes has this event generated or contributed to? As a result of what you have learned in the wake of this event, have you developed an automatic, unthinking response, one that judges you and predicts what your outcome will be in a given situation? If you suspect that in your most stressful situations, a particular tape is screaming messages of failure, is that tape a consequence of the event that you're addressing here? Number 5. What are the fixed beliefs and resulting life script that you have constructed as a result of this event? Do you suspect that you live to a script derived from this event? A set of words, thoughts, and behaviors that you blindly obey time after time? How have you limited yourself as a result of this event? Have you simply given up on expecting the world to treat you differently? Have you limited yourself to what you are as of this very moment? Rhonda, for example, lived a life script in which she resisted any opportunity to socialize with men, even in a safe and relaxed environment, fearing that she might upset a predictable, although painful, way of life. She lived to her beliefs, alternating between blatant promiscuity and complete and shameful withdrawal. Rhonda, just like you, cannot change the external events in her life, including some of the choices she made after her tragic mistreatment. What she can change is what she says and does about them now. While that may seem like a hollow victory, I can assure you that as it unfolds in your life, you will come to see that it is not. I trust that you are already changing your internal dialogue. I trust that you are learning as we go. For example, you might have discovered that you could not possibly have been responsible for the triggering event you are now reviewing. Many, many people, in doing this work, for the first time see the event with mature eyes. They discover for the first time that they have been remembering it for years with the eyes that they had when they were children. Their new perspectives allow them to make new judgments about themselves. Step 3. Test your internal responses for authenticity. For all of her progress, in other words, it's not hard to imagine someone like Rhonda saying, "Okay, I can see that the sexual abuse psychically disfigured me, and I see that my reaction to it was highly counterproductive. I've done an audit of my internal factors, and I can see how I reacted to what happened. It's no wonder I feel so bad about myself. I feel bad because that happened and because I reacted to it in that way. I get that. But now what am I going to do?" Well, what you're going to do now is learn the 4 criteria for an authentic self-appraisal. You will then evaluate each one of your internal responses, beliefs, dialogues, labels, and so on against these 4 criteria. Think of the 4 test criteria as questions or challenges. When you use these questions to evaluate your every thought and perception, you will see clearly how authentic or fictional your internal thoughts are. The 4 questions are, number 1, is it a true fact? is what you are thinking, feeling, perceiving, or assigning to yourself something that is objectively, verifiably true. If your internal dialogue, for example, was reviewed by independent observers, if people with absolutely no dog in the fight listened in, would they agree with you or not? Number two, does holding on to the thought or attitude serve your best interest? At times, you may hold beliefs because you're afraid to let them go, yet holding on to them causes you pain and suffering, frustration and loss. This criteria is simple. If what you're thinking, feeling, or doing is not working for you, if it is not helping you be and do what you authentically want, then it fails this test criteria, and you need to stop doing it. This is a huge deal. Don't listen to your own justifications about why you are tolerating thoughts and beliefs, actions and inactions that are not working for you. If it's not working, stop doing it. Number three, are your thoughts and attitudes advancing and protecting your health? We often have selfish beliefs that make us defend ourselves when we don't have to. Are the thoughts that you cling to generating a physical harmony within your body? Or are you constantly aroused and agitated, wearing down your body and subjecting yourself to disease? It may be that now is the time to understand that holding such beliefs is not helping you, that in fact, it's hurting you. Number four, does this attitude or belief get you more of what you want, need, and deserve? This question is as straightforward as it sounds. What's your goal? What is the target that you're trying to hit? Perhaps you say, my goal is to have a sense of peace within myself, an unshakable tranquility that flows from a rock-solid awareness of my own value. Whatever the goal is, test your internal response against it. Is the attitude, belief, or thought getting you closer to what you want? Or is it leading you toward or keeping you in circumstances that you don't want? Step four, come up with an authentically accurate alternative response. When you test your fictional internal dialogue, and when it fails, and it will, it is not true, it does not serve your best interest, it doesn't advance and protect your life, it doesn't get you what you want, then it's time for you to do what we'll call triple-A thinking. To replace the fictional responses, you've got to generate authentically accurate alternative patterns of behavior and responding. Let's look at Rhonda again. Instead of holding the belief that she is damaged goods, Rhonda will have to adopt a new view that she should be looking at herself as important and respected. She might need to consider the alternative belief that she is not guilty of one single thing and no one is entitled to judge her. She must also generate triple-A thinking that says, I have to stop judging myself. I did nothing wrong. I must be there for myself now and accept the qualities that make me unique and special. A second alternative that could be tested might be for her to consider herself as someone who has let her past dissolve, or at least that she has let go of the importance of this event. She has made a positive decision to live in the present, not in the past. Here's a simple technique that will help you engage in triple-A thinking. In your journal, you're going to make a chart as follows. First, divide your page vertically. On the left side of the page, list your present fictional beliefs, and you now know what to put on that list. On the right side, do some brainstorming. For each of your present beliefs, list as many alternative beliefs as you can. Then, you'll take each alternative belief and test it for authenticity using the four criteria. Those beliefs that pass the test are the truly authentic ones. Again, here are the four criteria for authenticity. Number one, is the alternative true? Number two, is it in your best interest? Number three, does it protect your health? Number four, does it get you what you truly want? Now, work your way through your own chart. Give this step four the time that it deserves. For every AAA thought, remember to test it against those four criteria for authenticity. Finally, put a circle around every AAA thought that passes the test. In doing so, you're beginning to forge the links of the life chain that you want to choose. Step 5. Identify and execute your minimal effective response, or your MER. This step asks the important question, if you need to take action, what will it be? The goal of step 5 is emotional closure, meaning that you can close the book on your situation and its associated pain. You can put that book of pain on the shelf, and you will no longer have to take it down and read from it on a daily basis. Notice that the term MER includes the word minimal. Your MER is the least thing that you can do that allows you to get emotional closure. As an example of what an MER is not, I sometimes hear people who are in pain plotting major events to embarrass someone when all it would take for them to feel emotional closure was an explanation and an apology. The concept of MER seeks to satisfy your need for closure without creating a whole new set of problems. It aims to conserve your resources by guiding you to reacting without overreacting. Analyze your alternatives for action. In thinking about your MER, use this four-part test. Number one, what action can you take to resolve this pain? Number two, if you were successful and achieved this action, how would you feel? Number three, does the feeling you will have match the feeling you want to have? Number four, remember the word minimal. Could there be some other more emotionally or behaviorally economical action that would give you the emotional closure you want to feel? Turning again to Rhonda, she would consider possible MERs by asking herself, what is the least thing I can do in order to feel vindicated, to feel justice, feel liberated from this emotional prison that I'm living in? Her father has died, but maybe she knows the whereabouts of one of his buddies. Maybe Rhonda's MER is to go see that person and look him in the eye and say, don't you think for a minute I don't know what you did to me, and I want to be heard. You need to know the pain you caused me. You need to know the crippling effect that your actions had on me. You need to know what it's done to my life and my marriage and my relationships with my children, you no-good rat bastard son of a bitch. Maybe that's her MER. Maybe she needs the cathartic effect of getting that said. On the other hand, maybe that won't do it for her. Maybe Rhonda needs to take advantage of the fact that there is no statute of limitations on molestation and go to the authorities, file a complaint, and have this SOB arrested and put in jail. As you consider your own triggering event and the nature and degree of the suffering you've endured, what is your MER? Maybe you don't feel the need or have the courage right now to do either one of the kinds of things that were contemplated for Rhonda. Maybe what you need to do is write a letter and write down all of your thoughts and all of your feelings. Maybe that does it for you. Maybe you even need to mail the letter if your event involves another person. Perhaps like Rhonda, if you can't mail the letter, then you might need to go to the offender's grave and read it to him or her in the graveyard. Rhonda decided that she must travel to the cemetery where her father was buried, visit his grave, and read him her letter. While others might feel that it was a futile behavior, it absolutely worked for Rhonda. When she read that letter to her deceased father, she permitted herself to scream, cry, and voice her most extreme outrage. When it was over, She reported that it felt as though a 1,000-pound weight had been taken off of her chest. For her, that was emotional closure. Your challenge is to find the same MER for you and your event. Part of what makes an MER effective is the action taken. Part of it is the AAA thinking that goes with it. Part of it is forgiveness. And part of it is re-scripting your life so as to behave your way to success. Let's talk for a moment about one of those elements, forgiveness. Although every situation is different, I can tell you that forgiveness is the common element that I have observed as being at least a part of every successful MER. Forgiveness can be a very difficult step, but one that may be essential to your getting emotional closure. Understand that when I use the word forgiveness, I'm talking about something that happens entirely within you. You should also know that when I use the term forgiveness, I in no way mean that I'm asking you to take the position that whatever may have happened to you in your life is now okay. The reason I believe forgiveness is such an important element is that without it, you are almost inevitably destined to a life marred by anger, bitterness, and hatred. Those emotions only compound the tragedy. You are the one who pays the price by carrying the negative emotions with you, allowing them to contaminate every element of your current life. Forgiveness is not a feeling that you must passively wait to wash over you. Forgiveness is a choice that you can make to free yourself from the emotional prison of anger, hatred, and bitterness. I am not saying that the choice is an easy one, only that it is a necessary one. Suppose you believe that your parent harmed you by failing to praise you enough, that life was never a joy as you grew up. Is that thought true? It may very well be. They, in fact, may have cheated you of praise, and therefore your critical thinking meets the first criteria. But remember that forgiveness of those who have transgressed against you or those you love is not about them. It is about you. It may be true that they hurt you in some way. There is certainly nothing non-authentic about acknowledging that you were hurt. I'm not asking you in any way to try and sweep that under the rug and pretend that it didn't happen. I'm not even asking you to trivialize it and tell yourself that it wasn't that big a deal. On the other hand, you must also ask, how much have you hurt yourself by maintaining your anger? Do these thoughts serve your best interest? They are useless for any satisfaction against your parent and definitely a negative burden on you. As a result, your perceptions and reactions fail the second standard of authenticity and therefore should be rejected. Does your lack of forgiveness advance and protect your health? Clearly not. Anger and vengeance eat away at the body as they do the soul. Once again, the thoughts fail the test of authenticity. So in other words, what you're telling yourself is true, but it is not in your best interest and it does not advance and protect your health. As to the fourth prong of the authenticity test, it should be clear that continuing to haul around a heart full of bitterness will not get you what you want. Therein lies the power of forgiveness. Something did in fact happen to you, but you still, in the interest of yourself, must lay it down and move on. The objective of the MER, then, is to clean up your self-concept. If your internal responses are cleaned up and your lenses of perception are clear, your self-concept will move you towards constructive behaviors that get you more of what you want and less of what you don't want. Remember what has led you down the path of pain and distraction. It is the various negative external events and your internal reactions to those events that have pulled you away from your authentic self. These events are the door dings These are the potholes. These are the collisions of life that have created damage to the vehicle of you and buried your authentic self below a rotting heap of life experience garbage. In order to get back to your authentic self, you must make sure you clean up all of the unfinished emotional business that is contaminating your current life and view of yourself. First, the process may feel clumsy. Testing each negative belief of your self-talk takes practice. You will catch yourself sliding into fictional labeling and tapes. You have a long history of learned habits. Habits called internal responses, and they will not go away quickly. But you can change your internal dialogue. You can change how you label yourself. You can hit the eject button on the tapes that you have generated and can overcome the fixed beliefs that have held you back. You can audit all of these internal responses for authenticity and generate AAA thinking to replace those that don't pass muster. Your authentic self is characterized by confidence, hope, optimism, joy, and purpose. It's time to start behaving that way. Starting today, it is you who must step up and accept the responsibility of the authentic life. It is you who must create the life chain that you want. You have the tools, now use them. Now you must remember that the world is not devoted to your nurturance. It is devoted to your conformity and compliance, independent of how that dovetails with your gifts, skills, abilities, wants, and visions. If you leave it to the world in general, if you leave it to others to determine who you are, you will not be living your authentic self as it was originally composed. Instead, you'll be living a fictional self, which is nothing more than a structure of convenience for the world at large and for all the people you encounter within it. To deny your authentic self is to sell yourself down the river. It is to betray yourself in all that you truly are. That is why I have sought to inoculate you against manipulation by the people in your life and by a society that is running its own agenda. That is why I close this book as I begin it. That's why I'm blowing the whistle on this con job. The marketing machines, your parents, employers, friends, all have needs for you to be a certain way. And in all likelihood, you have complied with and conformed to those expectancies at the expense of your own gifts, abilities, and dreams. Well, you couldn't stand up for your authenticity when you were a child, but you can stand up for it now. The first person that you need to assert yourself with is you. Bottom line, I'm telling you that the world may try to rob you of all the hard work you've done. I want to share with you a story of exactly how that can happen. Joan was ecstatic. She had worked so hard for so long. After her marriage failed, she had decided it was time to be there for herself. It was time to quit trying to make the whole world happy while she got pushed to the bottom of the priority list. She had spent so much time and energy sucking up to his overbearing know-it-all mother that once she got the divorce, it was like someone lifted a huge weight off of her chest. At first, she had been furious with herself for all the stuff she had put up with from her mother-in-law and sonny boy. She felt so violated and stupid for having gone along to get along. Now, after what seemed like ages, things were beginning to change. She had stopped beating herself up. She had decided that the only time was now, and she had to get back to her life. Really, it was more get to her life than get back to her life, because she had bailed out on Joan a long, long time ago. She had pushed herself into the shadows from as far back as she could remember. Decisions, large and small, had been made to please others. Whom to marry, where to live, what to drive, where to go on vacation, agreeing not to have children. Her life plan had become simply, don't make waves. But that was all behind her now. She had found her strength and herself. She had read endlessly, gone to therapy, and challenged herself in every way she could imagine. She had written hundreds of pages in her journal and was sometimes shocked at what she put on the page. Shocked or not, She just kept digging and getting real with herself. Finally, after months and months of hard work, she had rewarded herself with the culminating trip of a lifetime. She had spent 4 wonderful weeks at a spa in Arizona, where she had lost all of those last 20 pounds that seemed absolutely glued to her hips. And not only had she shed the pounds, not only did she look and feel stronger than ever, she had fallen in love. It was all coming together. She had found her authentic self. Joan couldn't wait to tell her best friends, Alice and Becky, the news. But Alice and Becky were anything but enthusiastic. In fact, they both responded with sarcasm and even anger. Both Alice and Becky were jealous of her weight loss, jealous of her progress, and questioned the realness of her new relationship. They were sucking her dry and putting down all of the hard work that she had done as nothing more than a flash in the pan. Didn't they see how happy she truly was? Here she had finally found a path toward what she wanted, instead of what other people told her to be. Yet her best friends were telling her that she had it all wrong, that her perceptions were fake, that the whole wonderful adventure was just some childhood fairy tale. Joan was at a critical crossroads. Would she stay the course or get sabotaged by these friends and get sucked back into playing the roles that were expected? What happened to Joan was not new. Too often we get a glimpse of our authentic self, we hear a whisper of what our potentials are, then threats arise. We can get pulled back to our life script. We can be persuaded that it was all a dream. Just as we are about to escape our fictional self, these friends hold us to the way we were and, in their view, always will be. Please understand, first of all, that this reaction from others is not always intentional. Friends and family do not always plan to hold you to a fictional self. Some do it out of a desire to protect you. Others are trying to protect themselves from change. What I have found is that most people really do not know how to promote the welfare of someone else's authentic self. Doing so takes both wisdom and a great big dose of trust. In essence, it takes an authentic person to know and understand what your quest for getting back to your authentic self is all about. Getting support and empathy from the people in your life is tough, because to them, a situation in change can look so terribly unstable. You are questioning every value and belief you have ever had about yourself. You're questioning your relationships, and it may not appear to them that you have clear ideas yet. For example, it may happen that you even question your relationship with God. Doing so is not selling out to the devil. You are certainly entitled to question whether your understanding of God is one you have accepted wholesale from somebody else. You might be asking whether it is true, whether it resonates at the deepest levels of your faith, or whether it just is because somebody said so. This kind of questioning, honestly pursued, can bring you to a stronger, more relevant, and more personal relationship with God. But you need to recognize that there may be people in your life who will not encourage you in that or any other process of challenge. You need to be fully committed to finding your own path back to your authentic self and your authentic life. You must learn to paddle your own canoe, and the less passengers you invite on board, the easier it will be for you to reach your goal. You have the right to choose those people who will be around you while you do your work, and to choose when and where you will do it. You have that right, and you must claim it unapologetically. There are 4 basic destructive patterns that others can introduce into your quest for authenticity. I'll tell you what they are so you can watch for them. Number 1 is overprotection. Number 2 is what I call power manipulation. Number 3 is something called leveling. And number 4 is safety in the status quo. Let's begin with overprotection. This type of sabotage has a basic message of fear. you are likely to hear things such as, "I really don't think you are capable of being more than who you are. You're just setting yourself up for failure. Just calm down or you'll get hurt. If you reach too high, you can fall and destroy yourself and everything you have. You mustn't get too lofty in your thinking. Just stay here with me and I will take care of you. It's a tough world out there, and really now, what have you ever done?" Overprotectors are extremely dangerous because their methods are virtually invisible. They seem so loving, so well-intended. Their influence can be especially powerful because it usually comes from someone you trust. The wisdom that they want to share is given in the name of love and concern, making it very hard to fight, particularly if you are the least bit unsure of yourself. Yes, it may be painful to try and fail, but it is the attempt that should be honored, not the fear of failure. Put simply, your journey back to your authentic self is not going to be a success-only journey. Steel yourself against the naysayers and do what you have to do. Okay, now let's talk about power manipulation. Power manipulation is the sabotage of your personal power in order to maintain a relationship. Certain people, sometimes those closest to you, may try to do just this. And you must learn to evaluate the messages you receive even from those that are the closest to you. I don't want you to become paranoid, but I do want you to listen and think for yourself. Don't assume you are being sabotaged if someone disagrees with your plan, because they may be genuinely trying to give you valuable feedback. But do examine their motives, and do so with your eyes wide open. Sometimes these people that are closest to you may be threatened by your personal empowerment, so that consciously or otherwise, they'll try to keep you in their safe little cocoon. The specific mechanism of this sabotage is to infantilize you, to treat you as a child, so that you will yield in a childlike fashion to the authority of their power. And remember, as you scan your landscape, be listening for your own voice as well, because it too may be the culprit. Your fictional self, with all its momentum, may be speaking the loudest about what you can't or shouldn't do. Either way, whether it's your voice or someone else's, be very careful about what messages you are willing to internalize. Now, let's turn to what I call leveling. By way of example, think about a person who maybe feels deficient and inadequate. They just know that something in themselves is missing, something necessary to being all they want to be. If someone else arrives on the scene, someone that apparently possesses that something that the first person feels is missing, a sense of injustice can rage. Resentment, anger, and fear can emerge. The truth is, people just aren't always real happy for your successes. If you let them control you with this jealousy, if you let them drag you down and define who you are, they will define you in a way that is convenient and non-threatening for them. That's what I mean by leveling. It's the attempt by others to compromise you, to bring you to a level lower than the one they see themselves occupying. In this way, they're less threatened. The fourth pattern is what I call safety in the status quo. Even when their life circumstances have never been sorrier, many people still crave to hang on to that status quo. They don't want change, even change for the better. That's because they feel safety in that status quo. They are living in their own fictional script, and who are you to try to mess up their performance? Who are you to change your life and therefore put pressure on them? In showing your success, they may not be ready to look at their own weakness, because even if the life they are living is inauthentic, it appears to them to be safe and easy. At least everyone knows the rules in this status quo world, and everyone knows what to expect, even if it's destruction and failure. These four patterns of destructive input can crop up at home, at work, or from within yourself. Be on alert for these dangers, and they will not take away what you have worked so hard to achieve. Here's an exercise to help you focus on how you or other people might sabotage your efforts to reconnect with your authentic self. Step 1. In your journal, write down the names of the people you feel, intentions aside, might sabotage you in your quest for the authentic life. Next to each name, remembering the descriptions I've given you, write down the category of their likely sabotage and the particular way it may express itself. Please understand that this is not a blaming exercise. It is merely a way of alerting yourself to those people who could undermine your pilgrimage in even the kindest of well-intentioned ways. Step 2. As to each person on the list you've created, decide what response you are going to give. Are you going to smile and express appreciation, courteously deflecting his or her interference, even as you know within yourself that you're going to pursue your own path? Or will you be more direct, telling that person to get out of your face and let you run your own life? There's a bottom line here, and you already know what it is. The world is not devoted to your nurturance. As I have said, it is devoted to your conformity and compliance, independent of how that dovetails with what you authentically want. If you leave it to the world in general, you will not be living your authentic self. Instead, you will live the fictional self that is convenient for the world. Again, to deny your authentic self is to sell yourself down the river. Don't give your power away just because it seems easier. You've worked hard to get where you are. Hang on and keep moving forward. When it comes to reconnecting with your authentic self, you need to take the attitude of trust but verify. Trust that this work is worth doing. Trust that you have within you everything you need in order to be, have, and do everything you want from life. Trust that you are the best judge by far of what is best for you. At the same time, be ruthless about testing your thoughts. Verify that your internal responses and interpretations will stand up to the test for authenticity. Additionally, you'll need to constantly develop authentically accurate alternative thinking. Having discovered that your initial response fails the test of authenticity, what other options can you come up with? Throw yourself as many lifelines as you can. Give yourself permission to generate as many alternative responses as possible. Then, test each one of them for authenticity. Pursue only those that are truly AAA. I'm not saying this two-step process will come naturally, certainly not at first. But neither does learning an instrument or being an effective parent or anything else that is worth doing. You already know that doing something well takes time and effort. Likewise, if you will only commit to doing it day after day, you can become an expert in AAA thinking and AAA living. Maybe you couldn't stand up for your authenticity when you were a child, or before you did all of the hard work in this audio book. But you can stand up for it now. Well, here we are. You and I started this journey together with me confessing my own personal sellout of self. I told you that I caved to expectancies, life chain momentum, and money. I was trapped for 10 years and had neither the courage nor the focus to do anything about it. I completely ignored my own voice, needs, and passions, and fulfilled what I perceived to be the expectancies of others. Looking back, that story probably didn't inspire your confidence in me. You were probably asking yourself, what the hell was he thinking? Now there's a switch, you dogging on me instead of the other way around. Uninspiring as it may have been, it was the truth, and one that I had the power to control if I had just claimed it. Fortunately, I eventually exercised that control, or I wouldn't be here sharing this audiobook with you. In a strange way, even though I was caving to the expectancies of others, they were my expectancies as well. Clearly, I was not doing what I consciously wanted to do, but I felt a vague yet strong pull to conform and comply. The tug of that life chain was amazingly powerful. I mean, you hang with family, right? You go where your people go, do what they do, and live in their world. My personal truth was terribly limiting as I felt a need to stay in the flow of my family and their patterns. It seemed selfish to think of doing anything different just because I wanted something different. It was familiar, it was safe, and at one level, it did feel right. Or so it seemed at the time. In those 10 years, which felt like 40, I cheated myself and my wife and children. I know what I now know, not because I'm smart, but because I did it all wrong for so long that it finally sank in. You either get it or you don't. I didn't get it then, but I sure get it now. Here's the rest of that story. After my conversation with Robin that fall afternoon, we jointly decided that regardless of expectancies, possible consequences, or the ever-present fear of change, we would stop burning daylight in our lives. We decided that the life we were living was the real thing, not some dress rehearsal that we would get right the next time. Time is the one resource you cannot regenerate, and we were blowing it big time. We decided for openers that I would stop whining about what I did or didn't have in both my personal and professional life and would jack it up and do something about it. I will give us, me, credit in that we didn't waste any more time. We made a decision, pulled the trigger, and in less than 90 days, that long and heavy life chain was broken and a new one was begun. At first, we talked about a lot of different options, most of which kept one foot on safe ground while one foot was reaching for the new ground. Reaching, but just sort of reaching. Fortunately, we came to our senses and quickly concluded, hey, don't halfway fix this deal. Don't be mealy-mouthed around here because we don't have the guts to go for it. If we're going to do it, we need to do it right. Do it all the way. Robin was also kind enough to point out that I must have had my already bald head stuck where I could look out my belly button because I had so totally missed the fact that she loved change. She added that her passion was her husband and boys, and that she would absolutely and without missing a single beat bloom wherever she was planted, so long as it was with all of us together. I hate it when she's so much smarter than me, particularly when it's in my supposed area of expertise. Because my data window had been closed by fixed beliefs and a life script that was set in the "you're trapped" mode, I had completely missed the resource that lay in my wife. She wasn't nearly as trapped as I was, and was way more flexible than I gave her credit for. I had failed to see her willing spirit about change. Live and learn. To make a long story longer, we decided that what I really wanted was to be somewhere different, doing something different, in a whole different world of people. With that overt acknowledgement of what I really wanted, with the event of saying it out loud, a course was charted. I told my dad first. I said, love you, love the family, hate my life, hate my career and this town. I'm gone. He said, son, you haven't got a brain in your head. You worked 10 years to build all this, and you're going to just walk off and pursue some harebrained deal? We must have dropped you on your head when you were a baby. Being ever the smartass, I responded that I wished they had dropped me harder because then maybe I would have left sooner. I also pointed out that he, in fact, had done exactly the same thing in his life, or he never would have gone to college, never become a psychologist, and never left his family's small town of 5,000 people. That gave him pause, But then he said that was different because he, unlike me, had enough sense to come in out of the rain, while I, on the other hand, obviously didn't know come here from go sick 'em. I've cleaned all that conversation up quite a bit for those of you with tender sensibilities, but suffice it to say, he thought I had gone way crazy. Notwithstanding the council, leave we did. We went to a new town that we chose, started a new profession that I was wildly passionate about, and embedded our lives in a world of new people who shared our visions and passions, both personally and professionally. I'll confess to you, there were some difficult times and some scary moments, but I can honestly tell you that I never had one second of doubt that I had done the right thing for me and my family. I had no doubt because for the first time in years, it felt so right. Once I plugged into and listened to my authentic self, beach balls were popping up everywhere and boulders were rolling downhill. I immediately felt vibrant and alive, as though I had gained back those 10 years. My life energy surged without limit. I couldn't wait to get up in the morning and hated going to sleep at night. I couldn't wait to get up and get at 'em. Whether I was working, hanging out with the family, coaching the boys' basketball teams, or just being with me, I felt totally alive. Everything that had been good during those 10 years was better. Everything that had been a chore was now so very much easier. I never had doubts about succeeding career-wise. Because of the passion I felt, and because my new life fit me so naturally and authentically, I knew I couldn't miss. I was so passionate that there was absolutely no way that anyone, my partner, clients, co-workers, or staff, could keep from being caught up in the energy. At last, I had that feeling at the end of the day that I had done a good job, a job I was proud of. And guess what? When my data window reopened for business, the possibilities I saw personally, spiritually, and professionally were everywhere. The company my partner and I started became the industry leader worldwide. I started writing books and doing television. I found new ways to make a difference with an education and profession I had lost energy for. I am thriving, my wife and boys are thriving, and all those family members who thought I was nuts when I broke the life chain, including my dad, saw what happened with the changes we made and followed us to our new life within the year. I guess I should have changed my name and identity along with everything else. Just kidding there, sisters. Just kidding. For me, geography, career, and lifestyle were important components of effective change. For you, it may be all or none of those things. What matters is that you commit to finding and reconnecting with your authentic self, whatever that may call for. What matters is that you challenge and rewrite your personal truth and live a life that lets you be who you truly are. All that's left to do is to create for yourself a chance. Everyone is uniquely different, and only you know what that means for you. If you don't fight for the chance to live that uniqueness, no one will. A racehorse has to run, a bird has to fly, an artist has to paint, a teacher has to teach. There is something in you that you have to do. If you've done all the considerable work in this book, then all that's left to do is to do it. I'll see you in the sunlight.
Self Matters, Creating Your Life from the Inside Out, was written and read by Dr. Philip C. McGraw. It was abridged for audio by Peter Michalos. The recording engineer was Del Little at Pep Ventura Studios in Irving, Texas. It was edited by Jeff Thomas of Wild Oaks Recording. Edited and mastered by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. The associate producer was Jessica Cassidy. Self Matters was produced and directed by Linda Ross of One Louder. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also available from Simon & Schuster Audio, Dr. Philip McGraw's Life Strategies and Relationship Rescue. Self Matters is also available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.